cool and limpid green eyes, a pool wherein my love lies, so deep that in my searching for happiness I fear that they will ever haunt me. All through my life they'll taunt me, but will they ever want me? Green eyes, make my dreams come true.
With their soft lights and eyes that promise sweet nights, bring to my soul a longing, a thirst for love divine. In dreams I seem to hold you, to find you and enfold you. Our lips meet and our hearts too, with a thrill so sublime. Those cool and limpid green eyes, a pool wherein my love lies, so deep that in my searching for happiness I feel that they will ever haunt me. All through my life they'll taunt me, but will they ever want me? Green eyes, make my dream come true.
And that is the proverbial question, isn't it? This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves from Henry Ford Community College. Happy to be with you today, May 28th, 2010, beginning of Memorial Day weekend. And coming up next is our hour-long public affairs show, Local News and Alternative Views. Yep, that's what we say it is. And let's try the best we can to dig a little deeper. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. This is May 28th, 2010, beginning our Memorial Day weekend. I've got to say at the outset, if you're thinking about getting out on the roads and driving out of town, be very careful. A lot of people are driving that maybe haven't driven for a while, or driving roads they haven't driven over in a while. And so be as cautious as you can. We want you to be able to get out there and have fun and come back alive. That's the primary thing. So take time, enjoy. For those that are staying around town, well, great. You can tell them all about this show and have them tune in on a podcast, because today we are expecting the mayor of Dearborn himself, the mayor of the city of Dearborn, John B. O'Reilly Jr., is expected to be here in just a few minutes, coming out of another meeting today, and we're going to ask him, oh my goodness, the list of questions we have. We'll see how many we can get in. Thank you, folks, for a few of you, our listeners, have actually sent questions in, which we're going to try to include and ask the mayor about those. My name, by the way, is Jay Koronick. I'm station advisor here at WHFR-FM and co-host of the show with Amy Powers, our WHFR news director.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Well, fantastic. Aren't we excited here in the studio? We've cleaned the place up a little bit.
Tidied up.
Yeah, one thing about radio is people don't normally see if we make a temporary mess of something, but with the mayor coming, isn't that the way it is? That's one reason I have guests over to your home every now and then, because it gives you an excuse. You have to clean up a little bit or straighten up or whatever it takes. Well, we're going to look at some of the local Dearborn news stories first off here today in Dearborn. The Times-Herald this week, they have a investigative tradition, a muckraking tradition. And by the way, muckraking tradition, that's a wonderful thing. It's where you go out and you find out what's happening that really matters and where maybe public officials aren't doing their full job. It's right headline story of the Dearborn Times-Herald this week. They certainly scooped the press and guide on this one. Lawns draw complaints. Subtitle, community leaders. Ordinance enforcement change invites blight. Scary sounding. Oh, pretty strong. My goodness. And they have a big color photo there of Dearborn City Council President Thomas Tefelsky. He has gone out on location to one of the people who have filed a complaint about overgrown grass. Shame on that grass. Grew too tall. From Bill Koblfleisch. And of course, I do believe it is every resident's duty to report to the city or the police, whatever's appropriate, any violations of Dearborn Code. But then the city has the challenge of enforcing it. And so here's the story, real briefly. A recent change to the way the city enforces its exterior property maintenance codes is turning into a quickly growing problem, quite literally, in fact, says the author of this, J. Patrick Pepper. Starting this year, city administrators changed from 3 days to 7 days the maximum amount of time between when a homeowner can be issued a citation for overgrown grass or weeds and when a contractor is sent out to cut the grass for them. Now, the cost for abatement is $95, comprising a $20 contractor fee and a $75 administrative fee. So I think you get the time between the citation and when they come out, 7 days now before you have to pay the $95.
Yeah, that's how I read it.
Okay. Along with the added time, the city has become looser on the height. Oh, my God, looser. While the ordinance says that 6 inches is the maximum height that grass can grow before it has to be cut, I hope the grass knows that. I mean, if the grass was just aware of that, why would it grow taller, you know? They've got to get the message out to the grass. Now, I'm being facetious here, folks.
Or the sun.
That's right. Mother Nature, hey, it's 6 inches in Dearborn. Don't you know? Okay. City officials guess that the figure is closer to 8 inches this year that they actually do enforcement, which harkens back to 2006 when the ordinance actually allowed for up to 8 inches. Now, I was here in 2006, and this show was on the air, and for some reason, we didn't cover that major breaking story that the height of grass was cut, pardon the expression, pardon the pun, although it was intentional, from 8 inches to 6 inches. I can only imagine the kind of protesters, good citizens, who stood up in front of city council and complained that 8 inches was way too high. Okay? I personally feel, and this is just one of many opinions on this hour, that is not necessarily these opinions are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College, not Amy, Dennis, or anyone else.
The administration staff,
students. No. We're speaking for ourselves here. My first thought on this, and Amy, you can give me your thoughts, is that it sort of matters what's in that 8 inches or in the 6 inches. If it's all dandelions or some sort of man-eating plants or poisonous ivy or something, then I think there has to be some enforcement. Something has to be done by somebody. But
regardless of the height,
there's some beautiful grass I've seen, grasses, native grasses, natural grasses that grow and stop growing at 6 to 8 inches. You can actually use that kind of grass seed. Never have to cut it ever, folks. But it looks kind of like prairie grass. It's just low prairie grass. And it's beautiful and natural. And imagine you don't have to cut it. And in fact, natural grasses, you don't have to water hardly at all, too. Now, they usually go a little more brownish at times of drought, but they still stay there. They hang on because they're natural. Okay. Well, compounding matters, critics say. We'll give the other side, and then I'll let Amy talk.
I was going to give the other side.
Oh, good. Do it.
No, but carry on, and then I'll
carry on. Okay. Keep with your cutting remarks. Okay. Compounding matters, critics say, is that the previous method of enforcement, which was based on inspectors spotting problems in the field and issuing violations on the spot, has been switched to a primarily complaint-driven system. Yeah, you know, we got 30,000 individual residences, approximately, in Dearborn. Maybe more if you include some business properties. You know how much time it takes to drive out to each of these places? And it would have to be done at least weekly, right? Because grass grows a lot. Some people cut their grass every couple of days, but most people in my neighborhood, every week. I cut my grass every 2 weeks. Ooh. But I'm still within the 6 inches.
You can be on the list easily. Okay.
I push the 6 inches.
Okay.
It's true. And I've had special journal shows all about grass cutting in the past. I haven't done my grass cutting show yet because we have too many stories to include that. But seriously, most abatement actions are initiated only after a resident has filed a complaint on a given property. And with a glut of foreclosed houses dotting the city's neighborhood, properties that banks are notoriously disinclined to maintain, the banks that own the property sort of when the mortgage kicked back to them, banks don't want to spend money in maintenance and even grass cutting. Well, some say the lax enforcement is becoming an acute problem, but how many inspectors do you need? How many people are still employed in the city of Dearborn that have time to do that? You want the cops to do that? Get out at every property with their measuring, with their 12-inch stick and measure the grass? And again, I think it depends on the kind of things that you're growing. For example, if you choose, as I have, and about a fifth of the homes in my neighborhood in East Dearborn have chosen to naturalize their front yards, which means it's a combination of trees, bushes, ground cover, and you can put a few little flowers in between there. Mm-hmm. No grass. No grass. No grass cutting. No grass watering needed. Okay, put a little water on the rose bushes sometimes. But, you know, it's, you know, I think it's lovely, and at least 20% of our neighborhood also must think it's lovely. Trouble-free, almost maintenance-free. If you want to, again, plant a little flower here or there, it's up to you. But what a wonderful answer. Now, everybody's private property. You've all got a right to do things. I don't think the naturalized yards, and by the way, I will say that if I didn't mention ground cover, the ground cover, ivy or other things, they can be more than 6 inches high within this naturalized setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so because a bush is higher.
But they're quite lush and pretty looking.
Well, they usually are. They're natural, but they're lush. Some people don't like ivy. It's got to be, you know, golf course grass or something in the front yard. But there's no restrictions on that, and rightly so. It's a problem here. And apparently it came up at the May 17th City Council meeting.
But, you know, I think the fact that the city's gone to counting on primarily neighbors calling in makes the neighbors far more contentious. It also, I can see where this is more of a problem now with far more bank-owned properties. Not all banks are good about keeping maintenance inside or outside the home. And it does become a real eyesore for the neighborhood, and it does bring values down. It's, you know, I think the majority of those type of properties, not necessarily somebody that's, you know, give them a break. They're on vacation or they're, you know, just may not want to cut
their... Certain senior citizens, they have to get other people to help them to cut their grass.
You know, other issues.
Limited incomes, they can't afford a $200 or $100, whatever it is, a month contract.
Right.
So,
and I think that additional, you know, $95 a month when you know a neighbor's calling in, it just makes for, you know, a fairly unfriendly neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But I have seen foreclosed properties even in my neighborhood in East Dearborn, which is, it's a nice neighborhood. There's a lot of a lot of homes that are still like more than $100,000 to buy. Used to be $300,000 and $400,000, folks, until the The curve went down a few years ago, but I'm in a very nice neighborhood. It's right next to a golf course, so that raises the value, supposedly, thank God, a little bit. But the point is that, you know, we don't have these enforcement problems, is what I'm saying.
And the timing
but
is also...
The foreclosed places, and there's three of them right now, they look pretty messy.
A lot of time, other area homeowners will just cut the grass and be done with it.
Well, right.
Yeah. You know, yeah. if need be.
Yeah.
But
it's also interesting.
Somebody
should build the banks for that and put it up among the homeowners association or something.
They absolutely should be.
Right. Because what we're talking about here is foreclosed places that probably 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, we've got some weeds that go 2 or 3 feet tall and strange vines, and it's ugly, burned out patches. Mayor O'Reilly has arrived.
All other discussions stop. You are on time.
Okay. Absolutely.
You're early.
Yes, you're 1 minute early. Right. Thank you. Welcome. I'm going to shake his hand.
If we go through all this, we'll be here till what, maybe?
2 o'clock.
Sunday night?
No.
Okay.
Probably not.
I'll look at all this and go.
Well, you've obviously met. Dennis Reimars is back with us now.
Oh, are we on the air?
Yes, we're on the air.
Well, we started with a hot issue here, Mayor, and it's not on your list, but I know you can go with the flow here.
Sure, I can go anything. Place. Oh, okay.
And,
all right.
Turn up the volume a little bit for you.
Well, oh, he gets volume too?
Pretty good, yeah.
All right.
Not only a microphone, but we can hear him too. Okay. Well, we just we're focusing, as we do every week, on the local newspapers, and what a hot issue here about Dearborn grass height enforcement.
Right.
How high do you think the grass should be allowed to grow in Dearborn?
Our law is clear. We went from 8 inches to 6 inches. So that's what the standard is for triggering a notice of violation, meaning it's time to do something. But in this environment, you have to use some judgment, too. And, you know, I understand the challenge, although the persons that, you know, the council president didn't have the information when he raised it. We actually are ahead of, I went back and had them track the number of enforcements we've taken this year at this up to this time versus last year, and in fact we're ahead. So we're actually doing more on this than he did last year. The problem is that the problem is bigger this year because of the cycles we've had with rain and sun, and so we've had a lot more growth. I mean, I see it in my own lawn. I don't know about you, but I cut mine on a Sunday, and last night when I looked at it, it was getting close to the 6 inches, and yet I cut it at a pretty good low level. So you have to balance everything. But what we looked at is, you know, we're restructuring government, and that's the thing that takes a little balance, because government used to staff up for the highest need. It was a huge mistake. It was done generally because there seemed to be enough money. And that's not the way efficient business is run. You staff for your lean need, and then you add on as you need it cyclically. A good example is in private sector retail. For the holiday season, you know, they know darn well that the staff that they carry all year round cannot accommodate a holiday season, so at the holiday season they bring on temporary workers. Even the government things, the post office always did that, bringing on holiday seasonal workers. So what we're trying to do is do this. Now, one of the things that we've implemented, which go in the field next week, is something I came up with that I thought is an interesting approach to tackling this, which is we're hiring some summer, like college students, that applied to be grass cutters, and we had a lot more applications, we had jobs. So we're looking at putting them out in the field, walking the neighborhoods, which is different than the driving, because some of these things, like this one, there's a person who's supposed to be patrolling this neighborhood.
Pointing to the Times Herald picture.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be patrolling this neighborhood and should have caught this. But, you know, when I had, you know, we use GPS mapping now to look at things. When we did the schematic for the neighborhood, we found that on that block there were a couple of homes that were listed as vacant homes, which we have documented as vacant, and some that are rental. So if they could be across the street from each other, the person driving down, depending on which direction they're going in, would have no trouble being able to see this one. They get caught up in that, maybe even do a notice of violation and miss the fact that across the street. Then when they get back in their car, they're looking ahead. So the possibility to overlook a lawn is there. And we're
well, it's a monstrous job. Right. 30,000 residences in Dearborn?
Right, 25 square miles. Oh, it's out close to 40,000 residences. So,
and we were mentioning, Amy and I, as you came in, about the foreclosure problem, too.
Right.
A lot of banks are not real good about maintaining the outside. outside, the exterior.
Right.
And I was mentioning in my neighborhood, which is Rotunda, it's a Springwells Park
area.
That there's three there, but they look pretty ragged, and somebody does come and cut, but it's like every 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
But that's where people can call in. You can call in and let us know, because this element is, let me explain what we're doing now. So we're going to walk every neighborhood. We're taking one inspector who's going to supervise four summer staff, 10 weeks. They'll actually go, two people start down a block, they'll drop the other two off, they'll go down, and they're going to have a sheet that'll already identify every home on that block.
Oh, my goodness.
It'll have whether that home is listed as a rental, vacant, whatever. It'll have prior grass clipping, I mean, where we required them to cut grass, so we have the historical date on it. They'll make notes, and then that'll be data entered every day. Now, if they find and record a home that's over 6 inches, they'll put the notice of violation on, because that's just a notice.
Right.
Then the permanent inspectors will come back and do the final, you know, yes, this is a citation, and get the grass cut.
Well, this just, it was beyond belief. I had no idea that things would get this intense in something like the height of grass.
Well, but we're...
But the city has got a great response.
We're
going
to get
amazing.
A residual benefit out of this.
Okay.
While they're walking, they're going to document raised sidewalk pads where we have trip hazards, because that's one of the biggest lawsuits we get is people trip on sidewalks. So we're going to document high sidewalks. Yeah, well, we're pretty good about fighting it, though.
Okay.
we get sued. I didn't say we lose them. So, but the point is simply because we want to deal with them, in an affirmative way. And then we're also going to look for one of the things I said. I sometimes see branches over blocking stop signs because the tree is close to the stop sign, and when you're approaching it, it's not in view. We're going to look for other hazards. So what these people walking through is they're really going to do a complete neighborhood inventory. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the summer, we'll have a data bank that'll have all kinds of information. And for example, if they go by a home that's supposed to be vacant according to our records and it's occupied, and we don't have a certificate of occupancy, we'll go back out and find out who's there and why they're there. And so on. So it's really going to be a chance to sort of catch up by having people literally on the street.
Well, we're sharing this hour with Dearborn's Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. We're thank you for coming by. Usually once a year, usually during our pledge drive, and that schedule didn't work out. We want to go on to some of the other questions.
Sure.
And I should say that the grass issue must have been in his head, since it has come up at City Council and so on, and you always give great, intense answers, but you've actually, I see, you've prepped for some of our general questions
I read them. I didn't prep. There's no notes. I want to make it clear. There's no notes. It's just what comes
didn't,
out.
Didn't want to scare you, but we've gotten some of these questions from our listeners. We'll see what we can get.
Sure, anything you want.
Just when we don't want to go over in detail this, I actually printed out a copy of the budget that was approved.
Yep.
Hard to understand, but let's not go into that. So, in general, what was cut or lost this year? This was a budget that, in fact, didn't really, other than personnel and shaving costs here or there, and that was, I could see evidence of that, and that's been talked about. We didn't lose any major services, like the pools are still in the same situation, scheduled to open June 11th and 12th. So, actually, even though the budget is much leaner, I would say, than in terms of the past, we've had some layoffs, some people taking retirement. What would you say? Well, have we lost any services that we might even notice? It looks like there won't be much.
There's going to be a marginal amount, and then, and then with the council, we've had to make some decisions. We're in an evolutionary process, so this budget is part of that process. It's stripping out some of the contingency funds that have been there. You know, what you have is a fund balance, and then over the years, for certain types of activities, there was some contingency funds that were set aside. So what we did is we got rid of some of that, so that there's really not much cushioning in the budget. We wanted to get down to what I'll call a real budget that reflects the true position. So some of the things that were one-time revenue added were funds that we had set aside, for example, on tax appeals.
Mm-hmm.
So we had built up a fund where we said, just in case, we'll have this money set aside in addition to fund balance.
Right.
We had some contingency funds for our liability. So we got rid of that so that we're operating on a real budget, which I think is important. There'll be some modest changes in some departments, which will mean, for example, some centralization. The library would be a good example.
Mm-hmm.
In the libraries, We're looking at centralizing a lot of the programming at the Centennial Library, which will mean come fall there'll be less branch activity in that arena because we're eliminating 28 positions. But you're talking about layoffs. Up until now, we've not laid off anyone. So we've reduced 160-some positions over the last few years. But by reducing those positions, we didn't have to lay anyone off. So they were just by attrition, retirements. We've got a buyout package we've got getting ready to go out. We're going to see what the response is to that. So at most this year, in December, we'd have 7 layoffs if we don't get enough people who take the buyout to free that up. So we've been able to maintain the workforce without having to get to layoffs. It's something we hope
But with fewer people taking retirement monies and so on, then there's less people to do things. But that's why you have to consolidate or centralize.
Right. There's efficiencies. We combine we combine some activities to make them more facile by putting things that were like business services are all now located in one place. That makes it easier to do cross training and
I'm sure.
We combined highways and parks into one division. So we're trying to create some efficiencies in operations, which can save some costs without reducing staffing. And that's been working, but we still got a long way to go. And I think that's the key thing is this is, as I said, an evolutionary process.
One of the questions from our listeners this week, earlier, they said, and obviously you probably have considered, but you probably won't need to be doing these things yet. Has the city considered job sharing, furlough days, or other options to keep people employed or most people employed?
Yeah, job sharing we can do. Furlough days are now you get contractual. The city has 9 labor unions or bargaining units, and so each of those have contracts, and they're relatively same, but some get very different. Police and fire are, of course, very different from the rest. And so those are all sorts of specific issues related to those contractual issues that go back. You know, many of them at the time they were agreed to, it made sense, and in this environment, you go, wow. Why did we agree to that? Then you have the civil service also. So there's a layering, and that's what people don't understand about public. You know, they talk about how public should be more like private, but the private doesn't have two different constraints, which is the traditional civil service that goes back to the 30s, and then the bargaining units and labor negotiating. So we have a sort of double layer that we have to work with. And again, it presents challenges that you wouldn't find in the private sector.
By the way, we just had a listener call in, and thank you for calling in. But we can't really accommodate this because we keep getting off topic and we got to go back and forth. But a listener said, in terms of city-owned sites, they say, example, CSO abandoned sites that the weeds are growing up to 18 inches high.
Well, those are closed sites,
but
we're in litigation on many of them, but we actually have done very well on that. But city-owned properties, meaning if we own properties, we have contractors cut them on a schedule of a week to 10 days.
But they're not in the middle of residential areas anyway,
they're not.
So they
might
be so next to them maybe somehow.
Right.
But okay.
Yeah.
All right,
so,
well.
And I'm not sure what they're referring to, but yeah, we maintain city-owned properties. We have a contractor, and we have our list, and they go out and do them. So they should not be. If they get out of whack, they should call my office.
Now, next year, because I think it was your budget director or the person who presented the budget to the council, said that we should, quote-unquote, never again cut into these fund reserves, these contingency funds that he felt that they were, we need what we have left or something. So that means next year, if the economy doesn't boost back or property income from property taxes boost back, we seriously have to think about cutting some of these services then, don't we?
Well, yes. We still have fund balance, and the question becomes, what's the appropriate amount of fund balance?
Well,
and you're not going to get a universal answer. Fund balance has two things. It deals with contingencies that arise, and obviously they do happen, and you have to be prepared to deal with them. The other thing that it represents is bond rating, because when you're being evaluated, they're looking at whether are you. You know, it'd be like somebody who's going to apply for credit and has been living off their savings.
Mm-hmm.
Well, banks can look at that and say, well, if you're living off your savings, it means that you don't have a revenue stream that supports your current obligations. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're a bad risk. So it gets.
And we don't
want
that.
Yeah, you don't
want
that
because money if, we
because
need
if you want to do something that's going to produce long-term growth,
right.
you have to have the capacity to bond. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how much? Is it 10%? Is it 15%? Is it 5%? Many communities are well below even 5%. I mean, some are really at pushing the threshold. We're still well above 10%. So do we have some room? Yeah, I think 10% is where I'd like to not go below unless it was really a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But I formed a we've been meeting since early this year with a Blue Ribbon Commission of representatives of different constituencies in Dearborn to develop a five-year plan for the budget. And the five-year plan would begin on July 1 of 2011, go forward to for 5 years. And the goal there is to really look strategically at all the options and then look at what generally this group of 28 people who are all connected to Dearborn, live here and are involved here, how they view what the balance is between generating additional revenue and cuts and so on, so that we can do it in a measured way, and we've got a lot of input for what might be acceptable or not acceptable. And it's been going very well. We hope to, I think July 15th, we have our meeting where all the subcommittees come together finally to begin to prepare the final document, and we want to have it probably by early fall.
I was a little bit just trying to follow the final stages of the budget presentation. Is that the final public hearing was announced in a Wednesday paper, and it was going to be on Thursday, I think, the final public discussion. And then it was going to be adopted on Monday. And, of course, I think with our weekly papers, and this is probably the fault of the papers, they should really give an extra week notice.
Well, that's actually been published. It was adopted. That schedule was adopted months ago, probably February, and was published then. It's been on our calendar and on the website.
And it's been a discussion in the paper for a while.
And we've had on cable, we've had postings showing it. Because that's set early on so that those dates are available as early as possible. So that was our deadline.
I personally, I like the idea of the committee to look into like a phased plan of if we have to switch or alternate services. I know some of us, not all of us in the community, that, well, we have no problem with 8-inch tall grass if it's nice looking. I was saying in Springwells Park, probably one out of five homes, we don't have grass in the front, or we have very little. We have trees, bushes, flowers, sort of naturalized, and a ground cover, which is allowed to go more than 6 inches. And those are nice, but everybody gets their own choice. You know, just because we're next to a golf course doesn't mean we all have to have golf course lawns, I don't think. I hope not, anyway.
And well, I do want to point out, we're stepping up our campaign on dandelions, because when I talk to our people, I say, how often do you write dandelions? And they're answer back to me was, well, our philosophy has been if people cut their grass, even if they cut the dandelions before they go to seed. I said, that's a high risk thing, and so we have a noxious weed ordinance, and we're actually going to begin to enforce it. Where you know, say 40% or more of the lawn is covered with dandelions, we're going to go in and say you have to do something about mitigating the dandelions, because that's one of the things that spreads so easily. In other words, the potential for dandelions to begin to impact other people's lawns is just so great that you've really got to say, hey, you know what? You've got a responsibility to, you know, when we say lawn or grass, we're talking about landscaping. We're not talking about weeds. And that's another factor.
Somehow in a totally natural environment, I don't see fields of dandelions. You know what I'm saying?
You're right.
Like in my naturalized front yard, the ground cover just sort of pushes them all out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've got some real vines there that I had to keep cut back, too, where they grow up the trees and so on. They can be a trouble, too. But
I have ground cover in my front yard also, and I have to tell you, it's taking the little maple seedlings and other things out of there, because then they'll dominate. But you're right. If you take care of it, it's
just
good.
Crazy idea. Snow plowing, I think you plow now at 6 inches.
3 inches.
3 inches. Well, you know, for me, I wish that wouldn't happen, because I got to go out and shovel then, because the 3 inches piles up to 6 or 8 at the bottom of my driveway.
I got a secret.
I could live with 8 or 10. I thought it used to be that like it was like 8 or 10 before.
No. People. 10 inches, and you're really basically closing everything.
I've only lived in Dearborn 30 years.
No, I'm talking about anywhere. 10 inches of snow at one time, and you're pretty much shutting down things. I mean, that's a lot of snow.
There's always drifts and things. At 6 inches, you've got probably 10 inches in the worst places. Yeah,
safely traveling. But I can tell you that the secret, I always tell people, you know, that there is an easy way to avoid having a snow plow block your bottom of your driveway. You go out before the plow and you do a trapezoid going toward the direction the plow will be coming, and when it comes by, it doesn't
bring in math.
And so what happens is if your driveway is here, at the bottom of the driveway, you shovel like this and throw it over here. When the truck comes by, it takes this snow up, and of course, then it throws this snow over here, and it misses your driveway completely.
It's an angled rectangle, folks. Yeah.
We should have that on the website later.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
That piece of paper, too.
That works perfectly. Because I can tell you, I do this every time. I get out there before the plows come, and I shovel my snow off the street because it's not hard to shovel at that point. You shovel
so off to the
snow
left, you're shoveling off
here,
to the left.
Off to the left, the snow plow comes by, and it just pushes the snow where it's supposed to be.
Okay,
and
this will be on the City of Dearborn website.
It'll be on the algebra page.
That's a big help. But I'm just saying, wouldn't it cut half... although maybe it takes more time to plow if they're 6 inches than three, but wouldn't it sort of reduce the cost somewhat if you waited till 6 inches?
Everything does depending on the long-term impact. Because the thing about this is that there is no standard environment for how snow and ice respond, because it's going to depend on temperature along with the other things. Salt doesn't work at certain temperatures. If they're compact, hitting a lot of ice, it's different and it's harder. So what has to happen, and our crews know what they're doing, they have to evaluate the time. What we did, though, that saved us a lot of money is we went to a midnight shift of like about 6 to 8 people who are there overnight and start the process, and that's really helped us bring in, because we used to bring everybody in on overtime early in the morning. Now we can bring them in on the regular shift, which has saved us money. But the key thing is, and this is varying all over the area, there are some salting, for example, you'll see salt-free zones and stuff. Well, salt-free zone means you're on your own, pal. we're not salting this anymore.
All right.
And a lot of communities are only salting intersections. We do that at sometimes. So it's a matter of taking the weather episode and responding to it as an individual thing.
I have to say that, folks, and this is one reason we like to have the mayor and other people from the community in, most issues are more complicated, more complex, not complicatedness, but more complex. There's more factors, and there's more things happening and more decisions that have already been made about these things than the average person really has time to understand. I think our City of Dearborn has been very responsive over the years to a wide variety of problems, and they actually have these contingency plans themselves, and they know in different situations how to adapt. So I do appreciate your making those mentions now, just to remind people and about the grass. I had no idea, certainly wasn't covered in the paper, of how complicated and or complex, not complicated, is the response to these things, which are valid complaints from many people. I'm just touching on some of the issues with Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. here until 2 o'clock this afternoon on the Journal Show, the station making waves, of course. And waves aren't against any regulation in Dearborn yet. So.
Sound waves at a certain level. Yeah. Yep, sound waves. If you cranked up your power to a point where you were above the decibel level.
But they actually have sound pressure level meters they give the police when they come out to do those enforcements.
Yeah.
Now, which is the only fair way to go, although some people's hearing better than or worse than others. Yeah. And if it's got too much bass, it'll rattle your house, but it might not be that loud, actually. It's weird.
But, the Wheel of Fortune is up too loud?
Especially that.
I love that show.
I'm just jumping because it was also in the paper this week that officially Dearborn Towers in Clearwater, Florida is up for sale.
Yep.
Only $2.8 million, approximately that range. Is that what you're asking for?
No, I don't know where you got that
from. Well, there was a value.
No, right there.
Most recent appraisal put the value at $2.8 million.
It did not. It put the land value at $2.8 million.
There's
a huge difference between land value and the value of the property.
Get some accuracy
I gave him all the copies. We had 3 appraisals done over a period of about 2.5 years. Okay. I know. But
You
know how often I read our local press and go, ooh, that's not exactly right. It's a good attempt, but it was
right in spirit.
It's not mean spirit. It's just that we go over a lot of information, and then sometimes what happens is one piece of information, which the 2.8 is the land value,
but it
gets represented. When they get back and they're going through their notes, they might pick up and go, 2.8, that was the value. And it's the subtle difference, subtle being the operative word, exactly, between land value and the value of the property with a income-producing building on it. Uh-huh. And that's the difference. Okay. It's 5.8. That the one that came up with a 2.8 land value
later,
ends up at 5.8 as what its true market value should be, or proper value.
Because Amy here was going to write a check for the 2.8. Yeah.
No, I thought if we pooled our funds.
Oh, easily.
Yeah, that's right.
Then we can move WHFR and have a remote broadcast facility down there.
No, we're not.
No, guess not.
Thanks, Mayor.
But it. Do you think, I was a follow-up question on this, and of course anyone could put a package together, do you think the current residents, is there enough residents that might want to make an offer themselves?
Well, we've offered it, and there's a couple that we're looking at, but really to get the financing. Because remember, they'd have to find someone who'd be willing to finance the operation. And when you consider the fact that you'd be looking at a consortium of individuals, there's no real assets beyond, they don't have the kind of assets that they could put up as collateral. So the collateral is simply the building.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty tricky. It'd be hard, though, I think, to pull that off. I mean, right now...
it's hard for anybody to borrow money, but you'd have to be a rather large, as you said, a company with a lot of collateral to back up getting the money anyway. Well, we hope that happens sometime soon. But
We're going to see, generally with real estate, we should see people who've been kind of looking at things. We've had contacts and people were notifying all those who contacted us about interest. Generally, the first 6 weeks or so when a property goes on the market, you get the first kind of pushback of people who are thinking, yeah, I'm interested in it. I've been looking at it. Let me give you this offer. They'll tend to be a little bit low, but they'll give you a sense of interest. And then from there, you kind of build. So if you miss that, and if you decide not to go during that wave and you don't get anybody negotiating, then I think you're in for a longer haul. But it depends on the difference between fire sale or saying, hey, are we going for the top end or are we going for a reasonable, let's move on.
I was just wondering what the percentage of occupancy was, because that makes
right now it's 75%, but we haven't been pushing it hard. One of the things we're talking about doing, and again, just talking about it, but I've got some work done, because if we're going to do it, I want to do it quickly. If we think it's going to be on the market for a while, what we might do is start renting it by the month, meaning Dearborn residents who are age eligible could rent 1 month at a time and go down, and we'll build into their lease the cost of the rental of furniture and so on, and then you just go down and rent by the month.
Timeshare. It's beautiful.
It's a timeshare for Dearborn residents, but it'd still be age-specific, so we're not disrupting the lifestyle there. But that would then begin to fill up the vacancies.
And great idea.
We think it just, it makes sense. And that's one of the things, on the appraisals, one of the things that hurt us is we're below market rent. And so they had to factor that in, because when they do the three approaches, they do, the income approach, they do the appraisal comparatives approach, and then they do the cost factor approach for replacement. And so the three approaches are looked at in terms of what the value is, and then they select sort of mean value, and that's what appears in all three appraisals. They range from $6.5 million to 5.8. The range of the three, the average is about, I think it's around 6.1 or somewhere right around 6 million if you average all three.
Here's a facetious question. You think Burton Katzman ought to buy it and invest?
And move it between the decks?
Yeah, why not? That's a small task for a company with the resources they have. How's that lawsuit going?
Well,
that's my segue.
It's gone well for us. I mean,
so far,
we've been able to get the judge to agree that our position is exactly right. They owe us the construction of a basically $20 to $22 million project between the decks. The thing that was really the incredible victory was getting it so that they pierced the corporate veil and said that Burton Katzman Development was, although it was an LLC and appears to have no assets, they held the principals responsible because of their behavior, and they held their trust responsible, which is really the key thing. So they went out and hired a bunch more attorneys, because now it got serious, and those attorneys have all come in and did pleadings and did motions and so on. So we're sorting through that process, but right now it's been holding. If that holds, then we're going to see some action. I mean, I've been surprised they haven't attempted to have a conversation with us about some sort of settlement. And I know this. I don't know if our attorney is going to be set me saying it, but I'm looking at it from a pragmatic point of view.
If they delay it long enough, maybe they will officially be out of business and have to go bankrupt or something. I don't know what they're expecting. Yeah. Although I understand they still have the development contract for Unity Studios in Allen Park.
Oh no, they lost that.
Oh, they lost it
a long time ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Redico actually picked it up. Who's doing our project?
Okay. Right. And Schaefer, right. Yeah. The East Dearborn project. Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's my thing is, you know, one of the things that I think our legislature has to look at is this whole LLC business because what's happened and. It's not just Burt Katzman, it's all over the place. Burt Katzman had 80-some LLCs, you know, 80-some different corporations that they were sort of operating, and most of them without assets. I mean, that's ridiculous, because if you're entering a contract, okay, if you don't ensure, which we did, that the party that you're entering has the assets and has the financial capability, then they just leave you hanging and they walk away and there's no recourse. And that's just ridiculous. And it's really gotten out of hand. I mean, as from the city's experience, we see people purchasing properties as LLCs and they're making them up as they go along. You go and try and pierce and find out who are we dealing with? Who is this? And so to have that kind of thing where you can have a corporation with absolutely no assets going out and doing business, entering into contracts and entering into obligations that if they fail their contract, nobody pays, nobody does anything, nobody's held accountable. That's, I think, really out of hand, and it's putting a lot of people at risk who are legitimate, you know, they're trying to do legitimate business. The whole idea was supposed to be that the corporation was insulating the principals, but the corporation was supposed to be an entity with assets and that it becomes a legal entity. When the legal entity has no capacity, has no accountability, we're in trouble. I'm just going to say, I really see this getting out of hand. It's something we need to look at.
So it can't be more than a few months or a year at most until there's resolution one way or the other. Either they pay what they owe us in dollars or build.
Well, yeah. And actually what was held is May 1st was the deadline for them to build.
Right. Yeah.
What happened is they petitioned for an extension. The judge gave them the extension on the condition that they pay us $3 million, which is our out-of-pocket. The $3 million represents what the West Dearborn Downtown Development Authority and the city have paid out of pocket to pay the debt service on the decks. So they have to pay us the $3 million, and in return for the $3 million, they got an extension to start building until October. So they're still under a mandate to begin building.
Right.
And so that's where we're at.
Don't see any ground being broken.
No.
Okay. I'd like to switch to another topic. We have only 15 minutes left in our discussion today with Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. in the new WHFR Journal is the name of the show. And of course, we're making waves here. green projects and sustainability. We had a speaker on campus from the local Sierra Club office, Michelle Martinez, in fact, and she said that they were circulating a petition and they were going to present it to City Council or maybe at least to Dave Norwood, who is the Dearborn Sustainability Coordinator or official, that would ask the City Council or yourself to sign on to reducing greenhouse gas emissions 7% by 2012 from 1990 levels. That actually, I think, came a recommendation from the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. What can you tell us about that? I don't know exactly what greenhouse gas other than CO2, what they're referring to there. Is that possible? I'm sure we're taking other initiatives. I'd like you to basically talk about what does Dave Norwood and the Dearborn Sustainability Office do. We also heard a rumor that he was going to present to the city, like by the end of May, which it is now, a report or a recommendation.
Well, actually, what he had to do by the end of May was get the federal government to approve our plan for use of the grant money that we had gone after. So we got a grant, 900-some thousand, and we had to present that plan.
$900,000?
Yeah.
Dollars?
Different things, yeah. And that's nice. That plan was submitted. We were one of the first cities to actually get through the process and get full approval, and that was approved. And so we have the authorization to proceed on the projects. Part of it is the new waste stream stuff that we're doing to increase the recycling and so on. So I think about $300,000 is involved with that. Hmm. There's some photovoltaic panels that we're looking at putting into some sites it's interesting with that because as we've gone forward and we're learning, we thought, you put up the solar collectors, and then you use them to power your own facility, mm-hmm. it's turned out that with regard to how we were looking at doing it, it's better for us to sell the power back to the grid rather than actually hook up and rely on it as the principal source of power, which gets to a conversation we had about this before.
Actually, might be much more efficient because as long as the sun is shining or at least a cloudy, bright day, you're constantly producing electricity, but your facility may not be needing all of that.
Right. Well, and the other thing is, and this is the key thing that people are not thinking about, we're thinking a lot about now, and I'll tell you why in another matter that we learned about. One of the things is that power has a different price based on when it's being used.
Yeah,
so
time of day.
You have during high
time
demand
of year too?
During high demand periods, you pay the higher rate. During low demand, you pay a lower rate. So what happens is that with this, you do the solar power, you sell it back to the grid during the peak hours when you're getting the highest rate of return for the power you're selling. The law now requires that as up to the point it's available, Detroit Edison has to purchase 10% of its power from alternative sources. So that means that if you can sell something to them, they want to buy it because they want to meet that threshold. And so they're working with us very well, and they're very interested in this. So let me give you the idea. We're doing this on solar panels. We're looking at waste-to-energy projects. We've got a couple of things that we're pretty far along, and they're working with us, and we might turn our sewage and other waste into either gas-to-run turbines to sell power back or do some other power conversion model. Mm-hmm. We're also looking at some other opportunities. But one of our neat things is the plug-ins. We're going to be the first public lot, and the only lot I know of that actually has plug-in for cars right now is Detroit Edison's lot. They have three sites downtown.
Okay.
We're going to open our new parking deck at Michigan Schaefer with 25 plug-in sites, and this is going to be for electric cars, and it's really kind of novel, but it's going to allow us. But here's one of the interesting things we learned. If you had an electric car and you only drove 2 miles to work, okay, you overnight you charge it on your 110 outlet. It takes about 10 to 12 hours. When you drive to work, if you're not going to need it, you plug in and sell it back to the grid at the higher rate, and you actually make a little bit of money while your car's parked.
It needs to be like a smart grid. There's electronics involved to make it a grid that allows it to go back
up. Well, that's what we're doing.
Yes.
With our deck, we're putting in the infrastructure now because we went to 220, because in 220 it reduces more than half the time it takes to charge, to fully charge, because they're going to make Focus electrical and hybrids right down the road in Wayne, and Ford is really moving in the electric model. So we said, well, Dearborn, we better be the first to offer plug-in capacity in our public deck. So
I'm on the list for a Nissan Leaf, if only to support the concept.
Nissan?
Sorry.
That's what I was going to say.
It could be available as early as December this year in Dearborn.
Oh, okay.
And that beats the Ford, which is either going to be
2011, early 2011.
Yeah. Well, if it's early 2011, I'll talk to my local Ford dealer. I can wait then.
Yeah.
Nissan is going
to
require
talk to Ford and see if we can get you the first one on the list.
Because,
we'll cover that.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
With all that money.
But Nissan is going to require each house, and they're going to subsidize it to put a charger in, and they recommend a 220 charger because it does take less time. But, if you charge at night, it's going to be less costly. And I don't know about the building codes allowing individual homeowners to put up solar panels.
Dearborn does. We've developed the policy.
You have to get permission, though.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's
got to look tasteful.
It has to be in harmony, you know, that kind of thing. But we have solar panel houses with solar panels now.
One of the students here, I gave him some info, and he went out and on his house he installed solar panels, and the buyback is only going to be a couple of years, and Michigan isn't known for its sun, but it's the technology is really improving. Well, it's great to hear. So maybe
when are these panels in place, the photo panels?
Well, part of them we're going to go on the top of the deck. So those will be put in during this year because they'll be the whole project will open late this year, early beginning of the year, and they'll be in place by then. So they'll be there. Okay. We're looking at the City Hall complex. We've got a project there we're looking at. So we're trying to work on those things.
Well, I'm gonna stay on my Ford dealer to see what they can do for us.
Sir, will the city be purchasing electric vehicles?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different options.
Okay.
We've tried some different alternative fuel vehicles in the past. But a lot of them are the fueling issues. Nitrogen was hard. Propane is one that still looks attractive. But what we can make with our waste to energy is a product that acts like propane. I can't remember the name right now, but it behaves like propane, which means you could run fuel. You could run public vehicles on it. So the question is, would it be cheaper to run? And give you an idea why Dearborn, it works in Dearborn, is our entire sewage collection system travels along the Rouge from west to east. So it passes right by the highest electrical demand facility in southeast Michigan, which is Severstal Steel. So they have a high need. They built actually on site a power generating system based on natural gas. But at the time they built it, natural gas was cost-effective, and so they're using it. They had to abandon it and go back to the grid because of the changes in natural gas. But since they're a high consumer, if we could build a transfer facility right by Severstal, which we have the waste coming right there, then that would mean that the transmission system would be very short and therefore more reliable and less costly. But the alternative, if we didn't do that, would be to produce fuel to fuel public vehicles. So either way, that's what we're looking at. There's a project
that's
in
exciting.
Flint that's been sponsored by Sweden. They're working with the Swedish government on developing one to run their public transit.
I'd like to go to the train station issue.
Yeah.
We did get, besides that, $900,000, which sounds really nice in terms of that project for energy sustainability projects. The $30 million for a new train station.
Well, $28 million.
$28 million, okay. But that's really your estimate.
He's so optimistic.
That's what it would have taken, and that's what you asked for, right?
Well, we asked for two versions.
Okay.
It's an interesting thing where, you know, you say, okay, I was stunned because I never believed we'd get the $28 million full bells and whistles system. So we had a second one, which was 10%er. It was about $2.5 million, and it was to build a basic new station there so we could at least have the accessibility to Greenfield Village.
Ground level.
And, the lights are blinking.
No.
And
Amy will get that in the other studio. If you're calling in, just stay on the line.
So what happened was we applied for both. Because we really felt that we needed to move we've had a train station for almost five decades, and it's been great, but we needed to have it closer to Greenfield Village, Henry Ford Museum, and the business district. So they gave us the $28 million version. It will really give us the ability to have great pedestrian access to Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village, to our business district. It's an intermodal station. It's going to coordinate bus service, train service, taxi, other pickup, eventually hopefully shuttles. So it's exciting.
My question is, if we have the money, and I think, because I went to one of the presentations a couple years ago here, looks like we pretty much have the plans. I mean, they were pretty detailed before we asked for the money. It's not like a pie in the sky. We'll give us some money. We'll think of it. How long before it's built?
2 years is the absolute limit. Under ARRA, a project has to be completed in 2 years.
Wow. So they must be digging a hole now. Trying to get construction people?
June 7th, we will select the final design engineering thing.
So that's week from Monday.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then at that point, that they'll be put on the task of getting the final design, because what we designed didn't have the really specific designs in terms of infrastructure, power source, all that stuff. So this will be the key design.
Okay.
And then as soon as that's done, we'll bid out a contractor based on that design to build it. So we're talking to roughly 2 years.
But straight ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's going forward. There's no, you know, there's nothing to.
And the only downside is, will there be any trains actually stopping there? We got trouble with with the commuting service that was supposed to be up and running for October.
Well, we're going to have event trains. People have a misconception. We didn't get some high-speed rail money
that we had hoped to get. No.
Mm-hmm. And Congressman Dingell just held a meeting. I mean, you know, he's a great guy. He was able to bring in the Deputy Secretary of Transportation that relates to this to a meeting in this district, and we had Senator Levin and Senator Stabenow had representatives there. And we had everybody there, Amtrak, the freight people, Michigan Department of Transportation, Seidel, we had SEMCOG. Everybody was at the table, and everybody was on the same page, which he was very surprised at. And he indicated that he thinks there's some hope that while we may not get the $100 million we were asking for, we might be able to get $50 million that puts us on track on track to have the commuter rail. But nonetheless, this fall, we will start doing events-based trains. Mm-hmm. We have the new cars refurbished. They're from Chicago. They're refurbished. There's nothing else we need, so there'll be event trains, like U of M trains going out to games, trains coming in to events in Detroit. So we'll be doing events trains until we can set up a regular commuter schedule.
It looked to me like there was a proposal mentioned in the paper about the additional money to have regular commuter trains weekly, that they were thinking of going to a countywide funded bill or or tax or something.
No, I
don't think that's
going
to happen.
They could try anything. I think that's difficult. What we really need to do in Southeast Michigan is create a single transit authority that operates all public transit. That's just a disaster. It's an embarrassment nationally that Detroit has such a poorly organized transit system. Mm-hmm. Two distinct and separate bus systems, really no real attention to train. We really are way behind in that, and we really need to make some progress, and part of it is we need to get serious about having a single transit system. But everybody's a little, that's just one of those issues that people want to just stay away from.
In the miscellaneous here, we only have about 2 minutes left, and we'd like to have you make some comments at the end, if you'd like to, about our situation here in Dearborn. But I'd be remiss to say that we've got to have a comment on this. Is Hooters coming to West Dearborn?
Oh, not West Dearborn. The only place Hooters...
East Dearborn?
Yeah. No, Hooters was looking at going into the old... not Rio Bravo. Was it Rio Bravo over at the mall? The Mexican restaurant
Near Farrelly Town Center here.
The one that was leveled completely.
Well, no, the building's still there.
The building's
it's right
still
down
there.
Evergreen here.
It's just across from, like, by Penny's and that.
Yeah.
Next to Benihana, right?
Yeah, what's it called?
Right. It was Rio Bravo.
It was Rio Bravo.
That's what I thought. Okay,
it's been leveled, though.
Actually, it was Chi-Chi's originally. That's what I was trying to think
of. No building at all there. It's
okay,
gone.
Yeah, that's the start. Well, that's probably going to be – that's where they were going to build it. And it was so funny because I got a call from a gentleman. He said, well, Mayor, I'm with Hooters, and I want to know would the city of Dearborn oppose us coming into that site? And I said, I've got three adult entertainment venues in Dearborn. Why would I oppose Hooters?
You're not paying attention.
If you're going to build a thing. So I haven't followed up, with our people, but I believe that's what the plan was they were planning to put a Hooters in in that site. And again, my children have been to Hooters and I haven't. But that's because my wife has asked me not to go, and
without her.
Well, no, she just feels that it sets a bad image for our kids. And again, this is a controversial thing, I know, because we just had the woman who, by definition, I understand for being, not right weight. She looked pretty good compared to what I use
right.
as
Everything's
my standard.
Relative, isn't it?
So it's all relative.
Sure.
But again, I'm not commenting positive or negative. I'm simply saying, those are the things. My kids went with sports teams there with their coach.
Sure.
My wife said, yeah, that's okay, but don't you go. So
So more importantly, what are...
That opens up a whole lot of other questions.
It does open up a lot of stuff.
There's three adult entertainment.
No, there's three. You haven't hit them all.
No. Let's for clarity's sake, Hooters is not a so-called adult entertainment facility.
Mm-hmm.
They have somewhat scantily and tightly clad young females.
And this because?
As weight people.
Yeah.
This
would you consider
rumors.
It a gateway restaurant?
You've read.
Yeah.
Is it a gateway there, Jake?
Yeah.
Okay.
Leads to other things.
It was several, somewhat facetious there. We have to conclude, and it's too bad because Mayor O'Reilly has all the answers. At least he's got a lot of specifics that we don't get in the papers.
Yeah.
Each week we try to look at all the Dearborn papers, the two major papers, and press releases from the city we get, and try to find out the issues. And there's still more things that you need to know if you're going to be a well-informed citizen. You're going to have to vote in a primary in coming up on August 3rd and then an election in November. So a lot of these issues are important things. At the very conclusion here, only about a minute or so, Mayor O'Reilly, but what can the Dearborn citizens do to help the city? Is it like volunteering for volunteer groups? Like we saw pictures in the paper this week, the people are helping to keep the pools open in a neighborhood. In general, what would you suggest for people to be better citizens of Dearborn and to help us out in these difficult times?
Well, I think being informed, because the probably one of the great liabilities is the misinformation begins to drive perception, and then people are acting on on that. And on defense of the papers, they have the same economic problems we do and you do. They don't have enough time or enough resources and staffing to do the kind of information